and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA. It's Sunday night. We are joined for a special thing that we do about this time every year. Some years I feel like I ask our guest, Kevin Pelton, who's joining us from Seattle. I feel like sometimes I say, hey, is it time for small sample size theater? And you're like, I don't know. It's a little early, a little early. So teams have played between 9 and 13 games. And when I asked Kevin Pelton a couple of days ago, he said, okay. He gave me the stamp of approval. So Kevin Pelton, the machine, thank you for joining us for our annual small sample size theater show.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to get too large a sample. Then we get into medium sample theater, which, you know, we usually do. Yeah, no. We need there to be some slightly fluky things happening, so we don't want to wait too long.
Okay, so we're going to go over some of the stuff that is sort of happening in the league that we question whether it's going to last. If I was a responsible podcast host, I would have gone back and listened to last year's small sample size theater and saw how successful our projections were, but I didn't. So we'll just focus on this year. And one of the things that has been the theme of the season so far, Kevin, is scoring. Scoring, scoring, scoring. And it's personified by the fact that as of tonight, and I don't think anybody's going to change, the Lakers and Nets haven't played tonight yet. But Kevin Durant is the seventh of these guys I'm about to list. But in Joel Embiid's playing right now, he could, I guess, technically become the eighth. But something like seven or eight guys by the time midnight strikes are going to be averaging 30 points on the season. That is crazy. We've only had a few dozen players average 30 points in the modern era. And I'm just going to go over them real quick before throwing it to you, Kevin. So as of this moment right now, it's almost 10 o'clock on the East Coast. You know, there's games going on, but
I think for the record, I think Joel Embiid is already there. He came in tonight needing 36 points. As we're currently recording with 8 minutes left in the fourth quarter, he has 44.
Okay, so we're going to have eight players, assuming Durant doesn't have a 2-point game against the Lakers tonight, which I would wager against. So Embiid's going to crest over 30. Luka Doncic is leading the league in scoring at 34.3 points. He had like a he's scoring 40. He's having games where I'm watching him and he's like kind of you feel like, oh, he had a good game, but it wasn't great. How many did he have? 42. Oh, OK. Sounds good. Steph Curry is averaging 33 points. Jason Tatum, who had a 40-point game on Saturday night against the Pistons, is averaging 32.3. Giannis averaging 31.8. Donovan Mitchell didn't play in the Cavs game Sunday against the Wolves, but Darius Garland scored 51.
He might be averaging 30 now.
You have to run the numbers. Donovan is averaging 31.6. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, after dropping, how many did he have today in the Garden? Like 38, I think. I should look that up. I know the Thunder put up 145 on the Knicks on Sunday, and I'm going to guess
you overstay. He only had 37.
37. Okay, I'm going to guess Tibbs is watching video all night. Durant comes at this moment 30.5, and Joel Embiid 8. 20. He's 29, but he's going to go over 30. Kevin, what do you make of this scoring and all these 30 point per game scores?
So this is interesting because we have seen a trend towards more points in the league in recent years. And for I'm sure we'll talk about that in a league-wide context. We haven't necessarily seen a trend towards higher scores or a lot more 30-point scores in the league. There haven't been more than two guys average 30 points per game in a season since 2005-06, which was, you know, Kobe's big scoring season. Allen Iverson and LeBron James was a part of it that time. And there's only been more than four once in NBA history, which came back in 1961-62, the highest scoring league year ever, where Wilt Chamberlain averaged 50-plus, and Walt Bellamy, Bob Pettit, Oscar Robertson, Jerry West did it, and then also Elgin Baylor in 48 games when he was limited, I think, to playing mostly on weekends, because I believe that was the season he was still in the reserves. So this is something that, you know, we're above that pace, and it's something that hasn't happened in six decades. So what I think is happening here, it's not really a sample size thing, because if you look at this through the same portion of the season historically, there's not that many more guys who are averaging 30 points, you know, approximately 12 games into the season, a month into the season, than there are at the end of the season. There's never been more than four at this point of the season before, which actually came in 62-63, the year after that. So I think part of what's happening is, so we have seen a trend towards players scoring more on a per minute basis. So if you look at points per 36 minutes, the only times that we've seen more than one player average that in a season have come since 2016-2017. And there were six of them in 2019-20 and four in 2020-21. But those guys didn't average 30 points per game because they didn't play enough minutes. So that's the other trend we've had here, is that minutes have been trending downward for stars. And that seems to have changed. And I don't know if anyone has really noticed this. Six of the seven guys on our list, not counting Embiid because I didn't look him up before that game was played, are averaging 35 plus minutes per game. And in total, there are 27 players averaging at least 35 minutes per game, which is the most at this point of the season since 2013-14, and by a wide margin. Last year, there were 19 at this time. So I guess with the two extended off seasons,
Joel Embiid is averaging 35 a game, by the way.
There you go. The combination of the two extended normal, or the extended normal off season after these two unusual seasons, and the fact that we've got this kind of more rest friendly schedule that the NBA has adopted over time, it seems like coaches are maybe more willing to extend their stars than they've been lately.
Yeah. So, you know, Luka is playing 37 a game. Tatum's playing 38. Donovan Mitchell, a little bit inflated because he's had some overtime games, three of them already, but 39. Durant, 37. So, yeah, that's a good point. You know, back when you're talking in the 60s, I don't have those stats in front of me, but I'll bet those guys were all playing.
We know what Wilt played, because he played every single minute. It was over 48.
Yeah, well, he didn't play every single minute. He got ejected from one game. But other than the game he got ejected, he pretty much didn't come out of the game. But he did have some overtime games that carry the average over. But so, yes, Wilt was 48.5, I believe, was the number. But yes, that's really good. You know, also one of the things that we're also seeing is just incredible 3-point volume and the pretty good efficiency. So listen to what these guys are shooting. Luka is averaging 8 threes a game, although not shooting great. Curry 12, that's not unusual. Tatum's shooting 10 threes a game and shooting 39% on them. 10 threes a game. Donovan Mitchell, 10 threes a game and shooting 43% on him. Durant's only averaging 5 threes a game, but you know, some of this is just, you know, guys are putting up, you know, huge numbers, or huge volume of more efficient shots. And, you know, it also comes down to free throws. Luka's averaging 12 free throws a game. Giannis 12 free throws a game. Embiid, 10 free throws a game. And you look at a guy like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he's averaging 8 free throws a game, but he's shooting 93% from the line, far and away the highest of his career. So you start to look through here and you start to see some efficiencies that are explaining it. So I guess the question becomes, Pelton, do you see this as something that is going to I don't believe that 8 guys are going to average 30. Some of these guys are going to come back to earth. I don't know if Donovan Mitchell is going to keep up that shooting percentage, for example. I'm not so sure Shai is going to keep shooting 54% from the field. But do you see the, you know, us, you know, touching those 60s records that you're just talking about?
I think there's a chance of it. I mean, part of it is how much those minutes per game comes down. You know, as you get into the dog days of the season, are coaches going to become more focused on getting rest for their players as opposed to, you know, keeping them out there 36, 37 minutes a night? That's the factor I think that could change it. But look, the points are there to be had in total. It's the most points we're averaging this season since 1969-70. So it's another, you know, thing that's happening at a rate unlike anything we've seen in 5+ decades.
Is there anything else league-wide that you're paying attention to? We didn't mention the getting rid of the take fouls, which is maybe helping a little bit, but I can't see it making that big of a difference. Is there anything else league-wide that has your eyebrow up?
Yeah, the take fouls, I think, are benefit to scoring and offensive efficiency. Cleaning the glass tracks efficiency on transition plays specifically, and that's the highest that it's been at this point. And I think that the, you know, getting rid of the take foul is a big part of that, in combination with, you know, you had efficiency had been boosted for a period of time because teams are running for threes more than they used to many years ago. And you put those together. By the way, when you mentioned the 10 threes a game, it reminded me, our former colleague, Tom Haberstroh, our buddy, he wrote a column, I think it was probably about a decade ago, maybe like nine seasons ago, about how Steph Curry should attempt 10 threes a game. And it seemed like this unthinkable number, like, oh my goodness, a player shooting 10 threes a game. And now there's just multiple guys doing it and we think nothing of it. So, you know, the efficiency has been pushing up for a period of time. The pace hasn't really gone up the last time I checked it, even with the transition take foul rule, but that combination, it's a lot of points.
Yeah. So Curry is averaging 5.5 3-point makes a game. So you go to a game and you see Curry make 5 or 6 threes. It's average. And so, by the way, I would keep an eye on some guys who are underneath 30 who could get there. I'd keep an eye on Dame Lillard, who is putting up 10 threes a game and hitting 40% of them. His shooting percentage has really rebounded after having that surgery. He concerned me in the preseason because he didn't shoot the ball well at all, but he has been in form. He's averaging just under 29. So he could get that up there. And Ja Morant is right at 29 as well. We talked about him on the pod a couple of days ago. His 3-point shooting has leapt from the low 30s to over 40. I don't know if that'll hold, but he's also putting up a career most per game. And then I'm going to just mention one more player, Trae Young. Trae Young is not shooting the ball great early in the season. Atlanta has had kind of a choppy start. He's been up and down. DeJounte Murray has played really well, but Trae's only shooting 30% from 3-point range, and he's taken 8 a game. So that could very well round into form, and he's averaging 27. He could very easily start making one more game, and he could be at 30. So keep an eye on some of those guys. So that's the scoring. I want to, Pelton, I want to talk about the opposite direction, some defense. There's a couple of teams in the top 10 of defense that I did not expect to see. And really don't know if they will hang there. But one of the big surprise teams, I don't know if surprise, I mean, they expected to be better, but as of right now, Portland is 9-4. And they are 6th in defense in the league as we speak right now. Now, they, Pelton, the last 3 years, last year, they were 29th in defense. The year before, they were 29th in defense, which was a central reason why Terry Stotts got fired. And the year before that, they were 27th in defense. Now, I know that they have made some changes to their lineup, including bringing Jeremy Grant in, who had a huge game on Saturday. But the other big signing that they made, Gary Payton, hadn't played yet. So, you know, they're still a small perimeter team. They're relying on Josh Hart to really guard guys a lot of times who are much bigger than him. And it's not like Yusuf Nurkic is brand new. Like, he's been the centerpiece of their defense for a while here. So that's up in your neck of the woods. What do you think about the Blazers? I mean, the Blazers are, they've gone from being a lottery team to being a top team in the West because Lillard and Anfernee Simons are healthy, but also because of this defense. Is this something that you think is tangible?
I think that they are going to be dramatically improved from 29th, obviously, but I don't think they're going to stay in the top 10. I mean, part of it is personnel. And you looked at last season after they made that coaching change, Stotts had traditionally been playing this very conservative, drop heavy defense. And I think it was something that probably frustrated Dame Lillard because of the fact that he knows how good he is at picking apart drop defenses. I've interviewed him about that topic in a feature that Kevin Arnovitz and I did on the pick and roll. And, you know, he saw other guards doing it to them, but that was kind of what they had to do to protect a lot of their personnel, especially being as undersized in the backcourt as they were. They're not quite as undersized now. I mean, Simons isn't really that different than McCollum. He's also been a weak defender historically, but they've got guys who are active. So Chauncey Billups came in last year and is playing a lot more aggressive defense, you know, trapping. This year, they're playing a lot of zone, which is something they kind of experimented last year, but it seemed like more out of desperation than, you know, it's something that would be a strategy that would help change the tenor of games. And we have seen that this year, especially they'll play some really small lineups. They'll go with Justice Winslow at center to close games. They've done that a couple of times recently, including the New Orleans game. And now you're putting, you know, three guys in Winslow, Jeremy Grant, Josh Hart, who are pretty interchangeable and versatile defensively around Lillard and Simons. So all that has helped them. At the same time, one of the things we talk about every year on this podcast is the types of shots you're getting stabilize more quickly than how well you make those shots, particularly how well opponents make those shots against you. And Portland is number two so far in Second Spectrum's measure of how much teams have underperformed the quality of their shot based on where it's taken, what type of shot it is, and how close nearby defenders are. And it's interesting because usually when we say this, and we'll talk about another team in this regard later in the pod, you think of, oh, teams must be missing a ton of threes against them. And that's not the case with Portland. Opponent three-point shooting has actually been pretty average against them, but it's two-point shots away from the rim. Opponents are hitting those at just a 38% clip, which is the second lowest in the league. So that's the big source of that.
I think there's room for you to come up with a rating system here. You can call it like the luck rating. You know, pick out a player that you may want to name who is lucky, but sort of the luck rating. But I remember this was something that came into play last year with the Celtics. You know, the Celtics, if you remember, were sort of bumping along early in the season. Their defense was really down below where it should have been. And they're, you know, they just weren't being very efficient. And the Celtics, you know, pretty much said, I mean, you know, I'm not sure that they, Brad Stevens gave interviews, but I think the message from the front office was our shot quality, both offense and defense, isn't matching the results. And we like what we're doing. And if we keep doing this, the numbers say that this should flop around. And I remember hearing that and going, I mean, okay, I guess if you say so, I mean, if your numbers say that, I believe you, but you know, if they're not going in, they're not going in 25, 30 games in. Well, guess what? Second half of the season, they killed it from 3-point range and their defense really did shut down the 3-pointer and they went to the finals. So, you know, I wouldn't say the stat is always, you know, predictive, but I could just give you one example from last season where a team's expected field goal percentage, both allowed and shot, did, you know, come back home, so to speak, and it made a big difference.
I remember Tim Bontemps wrote about this with Jason Tatum specifically, that he had been, I think, the unluckiest shooter in terms of the Second Spectrum metric that adjusts for a player's ability to make those shots to that point in the season. And after he wrote that, I had a friend in the league who texted me like, are we sure this doesn't mean he's just a bad shooter? And right. It turns out, no, he had been extremely unlucky at that point. The other team we were talking about at this point of the season, I don't remember if they came up in the Small Sample Size Theater podcast or not, was Dallas. Dallas couldn't make any threes. You remember Mark Cuban was talking about the new basketballs and how much they were affecting the shooters. And lo and behold, second half of the season and on into the playoffs, Reggie Bullock and Maxi Kleber and Tim Hardaway Jr. before he got hurt, all those guys got a lot hotter and Dallas makes it to the conference finals.
There you go. So, all right. So we talk about a team that's surprisingly high in the defensive ratings. How about a team that's surprisingly low? Right now, the Golden State Warriors, defending champs, who basically made a home in the top 10 of the defense and a lot of years, the top five in defense during their decade long run here of contending, you know, the years that they were sort of in the, you know, rebuild phase, they sort of were outliers, but when they've had their whole team, they've usually defended. As we start the week here, Pelton, 27th down there with the Rockets and Pistons and Kings, 27th. Is this a trend that you see continuing?
This one's a little more worrisome to me because it is not something that is primarily based on, you know, opponent shot making. The quality of shots that they're giving up is also different than we've seen in past seasons. So if you look at this Warriors run, even going back to the last year under Mark Jackson, when they lost in the first round, you know, the year before Steve Kerr took over and they started winning championships, they've basically always been in the top five in effective field goal percentage against, with the exception of the year where Steph and Draymond were hurt in 2019-20 and they ended up in the lottery. So far this season, in terms of opponent effective field goal percentage, they are 18th. And the other thing that happened last season, which hasn't necessarily been a trend throughout this entire run, is they were extremely dominant in terms of defensive rebounding last season, which is part of why, you know, at this point in the season, they were the number one defense in the league, I think, and, you know, continued that pretty much until Draymond got hurt for an extended period of time and their defense dropped off. This year, in terms of defensive rebounding, they rank 22nd. So if you look at their numbers, the big split is whether Kevon Looney is on the court or off the court. It's not even Draymond necessarily this year who's been the indicator. It's really about Kevon Looney. And obviously a big part of that is James Wiseman, who is now out of their rotation. And, you know, just has, with his inexperience playing at a high level, has struggled to translate his athletic gifts to the kind of, you know, impact in the paint defensively that I think you'd expect from someone his size and athleticism. But it's also, and I think this is a really interesting thing, the lineups with Draymond Green at center that have been such a staple of this Warriors run, including last season, have generally been very good defensively in addition to just being awesome offensively with more shooting on the court. This year, they've generally not been very good defensively. And I think that kind of points to the absence of Otto Porter Jr. because you no longer have as much size when you go to those smaller lineups. You know, Wiggins, Andrew Wiggins is a power forward, is under,
or Bielitsa, who wasn't great defensively, but Bielitsa had good size.
Yeah. And even Gary Payton II, who we talked about earlier, not playing yet for Portland, he played much bigger than his size defensively. And that helped him when he was part of those groups. So, you know, that's a case where I don't know who that player is going to be. They played, Anthony, when I was watching them the other night, it was Anthony Lamb playing with Looney.
Yeah, they've been having a two-way guy in their rotation because they're looking for somebody who can defend.
Yep, and he was making some plays out of the short roll at the other end. So, you know, that was big for them. Maybe they try him with Draymond Green so you get a little more size in those lineups without Looney or Wiseman as a traditional center on the court. But this is one I feel like that's that need in particular, or maybe those two needs, if you say a backup center as well, are something they may need to look to address via trade.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket. With Vivid Seat Rewards, score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. Yeah, the Warriors are a team that probably is in pretty significant, evaluation mode on what to do with their bench and how to retrofit it. I mean, I don't blame them for trying to go and give the young guys like Wiseman and Moses Moody an opportunity, but it hasn't rewarded them. And Wiseman, frankly, as much as I'm impressed with his tools, it hasn't translated to results. And, they may be, you know, a year ago at this time, as you mentioned, they were looking like a championship team. We were like, wow, they look terrific. They do not look like a championship team. There are moments when they look like a championship team. If you're looking at something to say, well, look, this is going to be just fine. Steph has almost never been better. Even in his unanimous MVP year, he wasn't shooting it like this dynamically. And they don't, you know, they still haven't gotten much from Jordan Poole. Jordan Poole's been slumping. You don't figure he's going to slump the whole season. But that defensive schematics and their bench is something, and, you know, and Steve Kerr's been talking about it, and obviously you can see he's been working on it. You know, they've stepped forward to try to make some moves. So, all right. I want to take a look at some individuals now. First off, Kevin, I want to start with the rookie number one overall pick, Paolo Banchero. He's been banged up. Has missed a couple of games recently. He has been terrific. Really showing the versatile offensive game that he showed in the summer league. The reason why the Magic's at the end of the day just felt that, even though he maybe wasn't as, I'm not even sure why. I'm not going to speculate why he was not being considered by some of the number one pick. I'm just going to tell you his stats. He's averaging 24 points a game. He's shooting 46%, which you just don't see many rookies shooting mid to high 40s, even if they're big guys. He's obviously handling it a lot. He's getting a lot thrown his way. He's getting 18 shots a game because he's the centerpiece of their offense. He's the hub of their offense. But usually that would mean that efficiency would go down. I mean, I could tell you, in fact, I'll pull up what LeBron was as a rookie. Now, we're talking literally two decades ago, a completely different era. But LeBron was the centerpiece of the Cavs offense as a rookie. He averaged 21 points a game, shot 41% from the field, took 19 shots. So, he averaged six assists. Banchero is averaging four assists, eight rebounds. Also shooting 77% from the line, getting to the line eight times a game, which is almost the most impressive thing that he's doing to me, is the way he's seeking a contact. And I mean, I don't want to compare him too much to LeBron, but the way he kind of is a big wing who handles, just comparison, LeBron got to the line six times as a rookie, just to point out that even the greatest scorers ever, it takes him a while to learn how to do that. So, Pelton, what's your viewpoint of the Magic's number one pick and how he's played so far?
I mean, he's been better than advertised or anticipated so far for all the reasons you laid out. If I'm reading this correctly, in this part of it, I'm looking up on the fly. It's the most points per game so far that any rookie has averaged since David Robinson in 1989-90, who had played 4 years of college and then served his 2-year stint
in
the Navy.
Yeah, he was like 24. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty different than a guy who was one and done out of Duke. The other comparison I think that makes sense, you mentioned LeBron, but Blake Griffin, somebody who is a rookie, averaged 22.5 points per game, was similar in terms of free throw attempts, but not as dramatic, but he played 2 years at Oklahoma, had that extra year of physical development after he missed his rookie season. So he was 2 years older at the time of his rookie season than Paolo Banchero is now. In terms of usage rate, his share in the offense, Paolo Banchero, fifth highest on record for a rookie back to 77-78, the first year that we have this stat. So the four guys ahead of him, there's one of these names is not like the others. Joel Embiid, Luka Doncic, two of the guys who are averaging 30 a game, Zion Williamson, and then Ben Gordon was the fourth player to have a usage rate over 30 as a rookie.
Well, that was a bit of a different era for the Bulls. And, Ben at times was needed. by the way, Jabari Smith, now he's had an illness. He hasn't been right, but I'm just going to reference how he's playing for the Rockets. And it's not the same at all. The Rockets have two ball dominant perimeter players who are using up all the possessions in Kevin Porter Jr. and Jalen Green. But just to point out, Jabari is shooting just 32% from the field, averaging 10 points. And just 29% from 3-point range. He is shooting the ball well from the line, but only getting there once a game, or two free throws, one trip a game. So, and I'm not even saying much about him. I'm just saying, like, it takes a while to learn how to play, in the NBA. I mean, we talked a little bit about Ben Matherin. You know, I think out of the gate here, Banchero and Matherin would be 1 and 2 for early rookie of the year consideration. Matherin's coming off the bench, averaging fewer minutes, but averaging 20 points, shooting 46% as well. He's getting to the free throw line 6 times a game, shooting 83% from there. He's a guy who he's a better shooter than I knew he was going to be, Pelton. He's shooting 45% from 3. I didn't even mention this to you before this pod, so I'm not expecting you to have in-depth numbers on him, but I just thought if we mentioned Banchero, we should mention Matherin as well.
Yeah, I think the common thread between those two guys is their level of physical development for their age and for being rookies. You know, Paolo, that stood out. I hadn't seen him when I saw him at Summer League since he had basically been playing at the amateur level here in Seattle and in the Hoop Summit in Portland back in 2019. I'd seen him a bunch back then, but not, you know, well, he had gone off to Duke, and it was like, whoa, this guy is much bigger than I remember. And even, you know, compared to NBA veterans, he is a physical presence, which is a big factor in that ability to, you know, draw free throw attempts, play through contact. And I think something similar is true with Matherin. Jabari Smith Jr. probably is at the other end of that scale where, you know, it's going to take him some time, I think, to develop his physique to that same point to handle the physicality of NBA play. And particularly in his case, you know, I think eventually, like if he can play center at times as your backup center and anchor that unit and really be a pick and pop threat against slower defenders, that's where he's going to be, you know, excel. And they've tried that a little, the Rockets so far. It's too much to ask for him, I think, at this point.
Yeah. That's, you know, the Rockets are moving at a sort of a different pace than other folks. Okay. I want to kind of go to the opposite end of the sort of production spectrum. We mentioned LeBron a little bit earlier. Now he is banged up. He is not playing Sunday night. That game is going on right now, and that's Lakers. Belton, LeBron is shooting 46% from the field, which I just praise Banchero. Boy, 46% is great. I want to put this in perspective. He's actually, to be clear, he's shooting 45.7% from the field so far in his 10 games. It's the lowest field goal percentage. Granted, it's 10. It's not 80. It's 10. It's the lowest field goal percentage he's had since his rookie year. I mentioned earlier he shot 41% as a rookie. LeBron has been a very high efficiency shooter for basically his entire career. Since 2009-10, his last year in the first time in Cleveland, he has shot under 50% from the field twice in that span. Once was his first year back in Cleveland where he kind of had a reset statistically. He shot 49%. And then once was during the pandemic year where he won the championship. He also shot 49%. He went through a period early in his career, midway through his career, where he increased his field goal percentage in 7 consecutive seasons. Better year after year after year. Which is, you know, and they were like years 3 through 10 in his career. It wasn't like it was rookie. He was building out as a rookie. He actually, his first 3 years got better. They took sort of went sideways his fourth year, and then years 4 through, or his years 5 through 11, he went up every year, shooting 24% on three point shots, Kevin. Now, he has not been a good three-point shooter for most of his career. He has shot over 40% just one time in his career. Last year, actually the last 2 years, he shot 36%. He's a career 35% three-point shooter. But he is shooting 24% on 7 attempts a game. Efficiency significantly down. And free throw shooting down at 67%. You know, last year he had really improved his free throw shooting, got it back up after a couple of years in a row in the 60s. He had gotten it back up to 76%. So that's a lot of numbers I just threw out there. I'm sorry for being heavy with that. I'm getting to the point that I want to bring up, Kevin, is what's your concern level about LeBron's shooting? And are you concerned that this is something that is related to age and creating space and things like this?
And the fact that he has commercials of him versus Father Time playing on TV all the time. Yeah. So I think there's, you know, kind of two separate parts of this. And so you mentioned comparing him to full seasons. I went back to look at 10 game stretches throughout his career so that we could kind of compare apples to apples. If you look at effective field goal percentage, this is his lowest 10 game stretch since December 2015. So this is a pretty significant change from the LeBron. This is not business as usual or like a typical slump. In terms of three-point percentage, a little bit different. We have seen him go through stretches like this. There was about a dozen games in February 2021 where he was shooting, you know, somewhere in the low 20s from three-point range and, you know, recovered from that to some degree. Obviously, that was the season where he later missed time before the Lakers lost in the first round. But again, he shot as well as he did last season coming off of it. So, you know, I think there's more variability in the three-point shooting. What concerns me is LeBron in the paint and in the restricted area specifically. He's at 61% there, according to Second Spectrum tracking. That would be his lowest since 2014-15. And even last season, you know, at age 38, he was at 70%. So that is a pretty significant change. And that's one of those areas where there's less volatility in terms of your finishing around the rim than there is in terms of your three-point shooting. So I feel like that's maybe where we're seeing the age particularly start to show up.
Yeah, he is in the last few years had more trouble beating his defender. And it's not really that big of a surprise. He's facing most nights he's facing guys 10 to 14, 15 years younger than him. They just have live legs. He's also been, you know, looking for the whistle a little bit more. I mean, LeBron always, you know, since he was a rookie, has worked on the officials, but he's been complaining in the media. He hasn't been fined yet, by the way. I wonder how many times they're going to let him complain about the officiating before they ding him. I think it's been two or three times. He's, you know, he's asking for fouls a little bit more. And when you watch the Lakers play, when LeBron is in transition, he is still devastating. He's still really able to get up and down the court. When the defense isn't set, he's able to slice through. He's able to get to the rim. He's able to get those and ones that he's the greatest and one finisher in the history of the game. And, you know, he still looks good. And there's a reason why he looks for those is because against a set defense, he isn't as able to create that space as he was. And he's also been faced with some injuries. The injuries, he's had groin injuries, he's had abdominal injuries, and now he's got an adductor injury. Those are the muscles that you need to sort of create that space. And he's kind of also protecting those injuries and dealing with, you know, challenges there. So what about the Lakers in general? Now, you know, it's kind of dangerous to talk about a team I've learned on this podcast that's actually physically playing. Pelton, they are talk, you know, I don't know if you looked up their expected field goal percentage numbers because teams have basically stopped guarding, them on their 3-point shot. I don't know if the stats models were, you know, constructed to, handle a team that is so disrespected from 3-point range as the Lakers. Obviously they're at some point going to get Thomas Bryant back and Dennis Schroeder and, you know, LeBron will be back soon. But I knew they were not going to be a good 3-point shooting team. I thought it was going to be their big problem. I didn't expect it to be this bad, you know, small sample size theory. You don't have to be an expert to realize that this is problematic, but they're down coming into tonight at 30%. On threes. And I don't know what's your projection, what you think, you know, how it bodes for them.
So if you look at that Second Spectrum model, again, that accounts for player ability, in addition to where the shots are coming from and how teams are performing relative to that. If you look at the bottom of the league, there's the Milwaukee Bucks, interestingly, are 29th in this, despite having started as well as they have.
They're 24th in offense,
yeah,
which I actually considered bringing up on this pod as small sample size, but they've haven't had Middleton and Giannis has not played every game. And so I don't think it's fair to evaluate them without their second best player. So, but yeah, to your point, they are underperforming offensively.
So they're like pretty substantially below the rest of the pack, and have benefited a little bit from this on defense. So their games have just kind of turned more defensive, I think, than they will be the rest of the season. And then there's another big gulf. And then there's the Lakers way below everyone else.
To use the Brad Pitt from Moneyball, there's all the teams and there's 50 yards of you know what, and then there's the Lakers.
Yeah. So, I mean, we already have seen some regression from them in terms of their shooting. Through three games, they were hitting 22% on threes. And that's when everyone was looking up, like, is this the worst three-point shooting team of all time? And comparing three games to a full 82-game season, which it turns out is not actually very fair. Since then, to get up to 30%, it means they've actually been closer to average shooting threes in the past 10 games before Sunday night than they have the bottom of the league. But it's not good three-point shooting. I mean, they're not going to shoot as poorly as they did early in the season. They may not even shoot as poorly as they have overall in terms of the 30%, which would be one of the worst three-point percentages in recent memory. But they're not going to be a good spacing team is currently constructed. And then the other question of it is how much of that shot making is about LeBron number one and also Russell Westbrook number two and not being the same finishers that they have been historically.
Yeah. So, you know, again, coming in tonight and, you know, Westbrook will probably make 11 threes tonight or something and totally undercut this. And, you know, I'll be ashamed about this podcast. He has actually made his only threes taken tonight, but he came into tonight shooting 36% on threes, which would be his career high. last year he shot 29. We'll give him 30. We'll round it up for him for 30. 2 years ago, 32. This is the year he was in Houston where they were playing pretty fast. He shot 26%. His last year in Oklahoma City, 29%. I won't go further. He's a career 31% three-point shooter. He hasn't been the problem. I think the problem is that the way the teams defend him when they take the three, that even at 36%, the way they defend him, it still is a negative. But for all the what you talk about Westbrook shooting, Westbrook's three-point shooting has been good. He's been above his career average. It's exactly what the Lakers needed. But his overall shooting is the worst it's been since he was a second-year player. And I think that probably goes to the interior scoring where he dominated for a decade plus, Pelton.
Yep. And, you know, one of the things that Tom Haberstroh and I also wrote about when he was at ESPN is we used an Stats Inc. metric called gravity that, you know, worked to assess basically how closely your defender is guarding you, whether you have the ball or not. And that's obviously the concept that, you know, is affecting the Lakers with Russell Westbrook, is that he doesn't have very much gravity as a three-point shooter. And one of the things we found in that research is how well you shoot threes isn't important to gravity, is how frequently you shoot them. So just even not, you know, teams are willing to give up, you know, a few shots a game to someone who, you know, is going to hit a decent percentage. This is kind of the, Bruce Bowen shot a decent number. I'm trying to think of who the best example of this is historically, but someone who's got like a very slow release, isn't going to take very many, might hit them at a decent rate, but you don't mind helping off of him because you know you're not going to
get that. He doesn't shoot very often. He shoots slow, but there are, you know, he gets open shots because teams cheat off of him, but he occasionally will make a few.
Yeah, it's a good one.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
He's Westbrook's like on the moon when it comes to gravity. I've said, you know, teams don't just go under on screens on Westbrook. They kind of go home. By the way, he just missed a three. So my concern about, I'm not concerned. I hope he has a good game. I don't wish anything against him, but my concern for the integrity of the pod that he has a huge shooting night when we talk about that. So Kevin, is there anything else that you early on here have looked at and something has jumped out to you?
Well, we're going to talk about the Utah Jazz. I don't think they are. I don't think they're any longer leading the Western Conference after losing back to back and losing in Philly on Sunday night. But
yeah, they kind of had a sort of a suspect loss to the Wizards, who are winning without Bradley Beal, and then lost the following Sunday night in Philly. The Jazz's offense has slowed down a little bit. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Utah being top 10, both offense and defense, up to a couple of days ago was really unexpected, as well as Lauri Markkanen, you know, far and away having, you know, an explosive season. Looking at the Jazz, what about them do you think is sustainable, and what about them do you think is not?
So I think the part that's sustainable is that this is an incredibly deep team, which, you know, makes sense because you looked at them on paper, you're like, after trading Gobert and Mitchell, they don't have a star, but because of the fact that they've gotten, you know, multiple decent players back from Cleveland and in Minnesota, and then from Detroit with Kelly Olynyk and the Bojan Bogdanovic trade, they've got a lot of competent rotation pieces. So in my wins above replacement player metric, if you look at guys who are above like 0.4 wins above replacement so far this season, the Jazz have the most in the league with 8, basically their entire rotation. And that's a nice advantage.
They've got 8 plus players, basically.
Yep.
Yeah.
The part that is probably, and then I think offensively, they're shooting a lot of threes. They're shooting them at a pretty good clip, but not an unsustainably strong clip. Malik Beasley, I think, has been, you know, kind of an underrated swing factor in that Rudy Gobert trade. He was one of the league's highest volume 3-point shooters. Minnesota now has gone from, you know, near the top in terms of 3-point volume to near the bottom. Utah already was up there because they shot as many threes as they did, but he's helping maintain them at that level, even without Donovan Mitchell, who was a source of many of those 3-pointers. The part that I think is less likely to be sustainable is they are the quintessential example of the team that opponents are not making threes against. It did get a little better on Saturday night when the Wizards went 16 of 36 from three, but they were number 2 in opponent 3-point percentage entering that game. The radio broadcaster David Locke pointed out on Twitter the other day that if you look at cleaning the glasses metrics that take out garbage time, it's not as substantial. Their 3-point percentage gets much closer to league average. But then the thing is, if you look at their overall numbers, that top 10 defensive rating is partially benefiting from those garbage time misses. So if you compare them on cleaning the glass, they entered Sunday 18th in defensive rating as opposed to 10th on the NBA.com advanced stats, which include all possessions. And that takes their net rating down almost a point per 100 possessions. So these are you know, some of those classic indicators of things that are going to regress to the mean.
So, yeah. So one of the, probably the biggest surprise about the Jazz is how well they were defending, considering that they traded Gobert and Royce O'Neal. And even if you, you know, we don't know what kind of defensive coach Will Hardy was, you know, Quinn Snyder had established a reputation. He was going to really have strong defensive teams. They were routinely in the top 5. And then, you know, Gobert makes a huge difference. But they changed over half their roster. So you don't typically see teams that change over half their roster and bring in a new coaching staff, be good defensive teams out of the gate. And yet they were exactly the same defensively by the numbers as they were a year ago when they had Gobert and a more honed system. So like that to me was one of the biggest surprises. And what you're basically saying is there's already some cracks in that. And although they didn't get blown out in Philly on Sunday, they only gave up 105. And they're on a long road trip. I mean, you know, teams are going to have losses. You know, the Cavs started out 8-1. They've now lost 4 in a row. But some of it was they were on a 5-game road trip. And, you know, it's the toughest part of any season when you go on long road trips like that. And now they're a little banged up. I mean, it just you go through those periods. So even if the Jazz, you know, take a couple more here on the chin, I still think that they're very much overperforming. What do you think is sustainable for them?
Yeah, like I said, I think the depth is going to be a huge asset for them through a long season. And offensively, in addition to the shooting, they share the ball tremendously. They move without the ball. Like, all of that has been a joy to watch in terms of the shot quality they're getting. I don't think that is, you know, particularly fluky what they're doing at the offensive end of the court. So there was a couple comparisons I gave for them. I wrote about them in my mailbag over the weekend. And the negative one was last year's Wizards, who we did talk about at length on the Small Sample Size Theater pod. These was that same thing where they were an identical 10-3 at that point, and had also benefited from opponents missing a lot of three-pointers against them. And lo and behold, the rest of the season, opponents shot one of the highest three-point percentages in the league against the Wizards. Now, you shouldn't expect that to happen with the Jazz. That's the gambler's fallacy. But it's a sign that what you do early in the season in opponent three-point shooting doesn't predict the rest of the season.
Yeah, I mean, also Bradley Beal got hurt last year, and the Wizards kind of reevaluated where their season was going. They also made, you know, pretty big trade midway through. So Porzingis last year or the year before? It was last year.
Yeah, although he played well after the trade. But the optimistic viewpoint of it was, if you look at teams that. So rerunning my preseason predictions with the minutes the Jazz have actually played, because obviously there was some assessment on my end that they're going to cut the minutes of their starters over the course of the season when I was trying to predict them, which they haven't done yet. They projected as around a 500 team. And if you look at teams that are projected around 500 and start 10-3, Odds are those are pretty good teams. They win about 49 games on average, between 48 and 49, and the vast majority of them make the playoffs. So, you know, I think that assessment comes down a little bit now that they're at 10-5, but I still think this is a team that has a realistic chance to get into the top six and avoid the play-in.
Well, they traded arguably their three best players. I don't know where you'd put Bogdanovich on there, but they traded arguably their three best players. And then focused mostly on getting draft picks in those deals. You know, I don't think they ever thought they were going to win 15 games, but they weren't planning on winning 49. I don't care what anybody says. I know that the Jazz are sort of like, we never said we were tanking, and I'm like, okay, I get it, but you traded your three best players for draft picks. And I know that I know that Colin Sexton is a piece, and, you know, Malik Beasley is a piece, and Markkanen is a piece, but don't tell me that you weren't trying to go downward. And if you're going to win 37 games, you're better off winning 27. So we'll continue to see the actions over the words there. But Markkanen has been one of the big surprises of the year. He certainly is an early candidate for most improved player. He's averaging 7.5 more points a game than he did last year. About 6-7 more than his career average, shooting 53% overall, shooting a little bit worse from 3-point range and rebounding the ball a lot better, averaging 3 more rebounds a game and really proving that he can defend on the wing. Markkanen showed some things last year and showed some things over the summer. I don't know if he's going to continue shooting 53%. He's a career 44% shooter. I don't know if he's going to keep averaging 22 points. He's a career 16% shooter. But Markkanen is an improved player, Kevin. And I'm not sure, you know, he's actually going to win the most improved award. But I do think that that's something where he is just out now at age 25 in a comfortable spot in his career. He has, you know, found a way to succeed in the NBA a little bit more.
Yeah, the idea of him defending small forwards, it was like, okay, yeah, maybe you can get away with that in Cleveland when you've got Evan Mobley and Jared Allen behind him. And look, he doesn't have that kind of support system in Utah. Their starting unit with Olynyk and Jared Vanderbilt doesn't have a lot of shot blocking in the front court. Walker Kessler is basically, as a rookie, their only rim protector of note. And yet he's still holding his own defending wings on a team that probably has even fewer options to defend those guys besides him than Cleveland did last year.
Right. And he's blocking more shots. His block rate is like doubled. He's getting more assists. He's not fouling. He's staying out of foul trouble. Like, there's a lot of indicators. He's getting offensive rebounds. He's never averaged more than one offensive rebound a game. He's averaging two over two. You know, he's just doing a lot of things a lot better. So, I think he's an interesting spot, and also he's extension eligible after the season. Mm-hmm. So I think it's already going to be an interesting thing that the Jazz might think about there. Do we hold or sell on Lauri Markkanen playing this well? But that'll be a topic for later on. Well, Kevin, thank you for bringing all these stats. You always make us smarter. You can check out Pelton's. Nobody produces more words for ESPN.com's NBA section than Mr. Machine here. You can check out all his stuff on ESPN Plus. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Jackson Ajello, our producer. Thank you for listening to Hoop Collective. We will talk to you on Wednesday.